what have I become? Do I stand for something or for money?
This is the song that plays behind a YouTube video that's been making the rounds. A man in a striped shirt with a serious expression holds up sheets of paper that read, "Who am I? Who are we? Who have I become? The police or the people? Black or white? Do we have to pick a side?" The man appears to be African American, and a woman comes in. Is she white? Slowly, one by one, children enter the family photo, four of them huddled in close by the time it's done.
But I got to know.
It's a simple video, but it leaves a lot of complex questions, and we're apparently not the only ones who think so. As of this morning, last time I checked, the video had gotten 18,995 views on YouTube. The creator of that video, Oak Grove Pastor Alex Bryant, is here with us this morning. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Pastor Bryant, it's great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what prompted you, first of all, to create this video? Can you take us back to what you were experiencing when you started making plans for this?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for being here. And that video came as a result of the climate of America over the last couple of months and weeks and years, really. We've seen some police shootings, and that's just becoming a hot topic. And so that week, there were a couple of people that had been shot by police. And Thursday night, the day before we made the video, there were five police officers that were shot in Dallas. And I was just contemplating that and looking at it and thinking about it and thinking about what my response would be. But I really didn't process anything then. And so Friday morning, I woke up. I took my oldest son to physical therapy at Centerpoint. He had knee surgery. And while he was in physical therapy, I just began to think about all that was going on and what my response would be to that.
I want to talk to you about specifically what it was you were thinking, because it seems like there is an expectation that our responses to what's happening in the country right now would be divided along either racial lines or maybe professional lines.
Yeah.
Like, if you are a police officer, you might feel one way. If you're not, you might feel another. That's kind of the expectation. But it sounds like it wasn't quite that simple for you.
No, it's not. Based on our family makeup, I am a black man and my wife is a white woman, and we have five mixed kids, four boys and a little girl. And I was pastoring in Ferguson and in St. Louis when Ferguson happened, and we had discussions with our kids then about what it means and do we have to fear the police? Are all police bad? Are they trying to kill black people? And so
and you were actually in Ferguson?
I was pastoring about 5 miles from Ferguson at that time. And so when it was all going down, I had police officer friends that were there. Guy I coached football with was on the front lines for a couple weeks. And so we helped our kids process through that. And at the same time, I know a lot of good police officers. I have police officers in my family, and about five of them. And so I don't have the view that all police officers are bad. At the same time, I'm a black man, and I do understand what black people are feeling and thinking in America. There's a lot of emotion going on. And so I wanted to really take some time to process it for myself. And after the police officers were shot in Dallas that Thursday night, Friday morning was really one of the first times I had to stop and think about it. And I wanted to get my response, not only for myself, but for my family, for my kids. But also, I know there's people that are looking to me for a voice, being a pastor. And I was listening to that song, "Who Am I?" And it was from the movie Annie, and and ironically enough, my daughter had just had her tonsils out a couple of weeks before, and I was staying home with her for a couple of days, and that's the movie she wanted to watch. So as a dad, one little girl, she's the baby, I watched it about 10 times. And so it was actually a pretty good movie, and I liked that song. It really made me start to think. And so when I was thinking about all the events that happened and my response, that song came to mind, and I just played it over and over. And on the way home, my son came back from physical therapy. I played the song about five times on our way home, and he saw me just, you know, tearing up a little bit, just thinking about it. And
what do you think it was in that song that you connected with what had been happening between police and communities?
Yeah. You know, it really goes back to that movie where Cameron Diaz has this change of, you know, who am I? Like, what, you know, she was one way at the beginning, and by the end of it, there was a redeeming value. And the same with Jamie Foxx's character. You know, he was out for money, but by the end of it, and trying to win an election, and by the end of it, he was willing to throw it all away for this little girl who had touched their hearts, who had pierced their heart. She was kind of the go-between and made really people stop and think about what's so important. And so that was kind of the message that came from me, and it just resonated. Who am I? And then it was like, as Americans, who are we? We're in this election season as well, so I was thinking about all those things and really trying to put it all together. And
you're describing a journey that really started for you quite a long time ago, if you consider Ferguson and the shooting death of Michael Brown to be the beginning of this journey for you that led to this video. Yeah. Are there, that day when your son was in physical therapy, was that day a turning point for you and how you have been processing this?
Well, actually, in to go even further back for me, Gina, when I married my wife 21 years ago, being a black man who married a white woman in America, that was the start of the journey. And I'm not going to sit before you and say that I've experienced a lot of racism or prejudice, because I haven't. I've been fortunate. There are a lot of black people who have, and I talk to them. And so I always try to think about my experience, but then I always try to put myself in other people's shoes and think about their experience. I know a lot of good white people who aren't racially prejudiced, but they're just maybe racially ignorant and or insensitive. And I try to be a person that they can approach and talk to with some of those questions that people may have, or, you know, just those things of, I know I'm probably not supposed to ask this, but I feel comfortable around you. What does this mean? And so my wife and I have always felt we were going to be used by the makeup of our marriage, the makeup of our family, as those go-betweens between the races and between the generations. And so, you know, that morning when I was thinking about all this, I really felt like I was inspired by God, because I couldn't have arrived at all that on my own. I had all these thoughts in my head, and I was saying a prayer, and I really felt like God giving me exactly what he wanted me to say, and that was the points on the note cards. And so when I got home, my wife saw that I was a little bit, you know, shaken. And so she's like, well, what's going on? And I like to write. I like to journal. And she's like, why don't you go and write? And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the basement and she's going to watch the kids. And I came upstairs in about 10 minutes. She's like, that was fast. And I gave her the points that I had. And she's like, this is good. She's like, I think that we need to get the kids involved with this. I told her how we wanted to do it. Just the inspiration came to me to put it on note cards, make a video. And it just kind of went from there. You know,
I'm interested in your role as a pastor, because it's interesting to me, first of all, that you chose to put this online and that this didn't transform necessarily into, say, a sermon where you already have an audience, you already have a place, a forum to speak with people and to influence their hearts and minds. But instead, you took it to this broader audience. And your role is a go-between, because when you describe being a go-between based on the makeup of your family, also being a pastor, the idea really also is to be a go-between between
people and God.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, you know, I don't consider myself part of the technological generation. I mean, it's people that know me know, they're like, how did you do that? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have an iPad. I use a composition notebook. I'm not very much in the technology, but I recognize the power of it. And I've always tried to surround myself with young people who recognize the power of social media. And so when I was pastoring in Florida about 10 years ago, there were a few young people around me that talked to me about the power of video. And they started to talk to me about my Facebook. I travel and speak at camps and youth events and stuff. And so I started to see that there was a little bit of a following. So I've often been aware of the power of that. And this was just like the perfect storm. You know, I knew that people would be listening. When we made the video and when we posted it, we posted it on Facebook. I thought maybe it'd get, you know, 8,000-10,000 views, and just surprised that it had gone to 33-34 million. It's unbelievable.
Do you see the makeup of your family as coming with certain responsibilities socially?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we all have responsibilities, and I think that we just have to open up our minds and eyes and see that. When I was getting married, and when I was marrying my wife in 1995, there were people that would tell me that, hey, this might be a problem for you later on. And I acknowledge that, and I saw that, but I also saw it as an opportunity because, you know, we were friends from before, and I knew that, you know, me being a black man and her being a white woman, that we were going to have certain opportunities as well as certain setbacks because of it. And we've always tried to look at the positive side of things, and we've always tried to take any opportunity to come. And we realize that we're not only responsible for ourselves, but for those that are watching us, those that are following us, and the generation behind us. And so we've always tried to be responsible like that, because I think about not only my kids, but other people that are looking and watching. I want to set a good example.
The note cards, I mean, the choice to write the message with these note cards and play the song and for all of you to remain silent, what's behind that decision?
That was just an inspiration, I really believe, from God. Because people that know me, they know that I like to talk, and I can get to be very verbose. And but I knew when that morning when I went downstairs and wrote, it was just like we're talking now, is what I was told to do, and I was just listening. It's like, right? There's I usually write in journal, but this time it came to me in bullet points, and so
questions,
yes. And so I did that, and then it's like, I don't want you to say a word. I just want you to use this song. I want your family to be a part of it and use these note cards. And so that's what we did.
What seems to kind of work about that on some level is that part of the question, a big part of the questions you're asking there is about that gap between perception and depth, sort of like a surface level judgment that you might make when you see someone and don't know anything about them and the deeper reality of their lives. So every time another member of your family comes into the frame and every time you ask a question, it complicates the picture a little bit, makes you question your own assumptions that you might have been making just a moment earlier. Do you feel like that is part of what's going on here? Okay. Assumptions needing to be challenged?
That's interesting that you bring that up, Gina, because we've always looked at, and that was my wife's idea first, to bring the kids in one at a time. And we've noticed with our kids being biracial, they have different shades, they have different hair. And so it's always a point of topic at our family and parties, and we always joke about it. At one time, ladies at our church in Florida, our kids get a little bit lighter. And so, you know, our oldest one's a little bit darker, and down to our number four boy, he looks like a little white kid, blonde hair. And so they always made the joke that it looked like my ink cartridge ran out. I don't know that I like them talking about my ink cartridge, but that was the joke. And so, you know, from the point of our number three son, people always say, well, he looks a little bit like he's Dominican Republic. And so we wanted to pose that as, who are we? You don't really know. You know, my wife, people have emailed us and asked, is she Asian? Is she, you know, white? What is she? Is she mixed? And so that's all part of it, because it's part of the forming a discussion, a talk, and to feel comfortable enough to ask questions, to engage people. And, you know, there are no definitives. I mean, we don't know. And so we want people to be contemplative, but we also want them to feel comfortable enough to ask questions that'll lead to dialogue.
Were you surprised that your video reached as many people as it did?
Absolutely. We had no idea. I mean, I literally, when we made it, we end up posting it, and it's like 313, 318. It actually posted twice because I'm not the technology person. I didn't know what I was doing. And so what we were promising our kids, if we get this done, we do it right, we'll go to Chick-fil-A when we're done. And so I said to my wife, I was like, I you know, this seems pretty cool. Maybe we can get 10,000 views. And so that was kind of what we were thinking. And we posted the video. We live in Oak Grove. We drove to Chick-fil-A in Blue Springs, and it had already been shared 47 times. By the time we got to Chick-fil-A, like 4,000 views. We eat there. By the time we're done, it's at 10,000 views. And the kids are just like checking it left and right. My teenage boys, we're going to be viral. I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess, whatever. And so by the time we left Chick-fil-A, it had like 18, 20,000 views. And then it gets interesting from there, because you just don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, people were watching it, and I didn't have to check the video because I'd had friends calling me, texting me, emailing me, your video's at 1.2 million, your video's at 3.4 million. And so it's just like, it was overwhelming. And so you just don't know.
Any sense from the feedback people have given, either through comments or by talking to you directly, about what it is that made this video stand out for them, that connected with them?
Yeah, the response has been absolutely overwhelming. I've received personally on Facebook about 4,000 or 5,000 emails. And I'm doing my best to answer them all. I try to answer about 100 to 200 of them a day. But there's a few things that are just overwhelming that people are saying to us. First of all, they're saying thank you. Second of all, you spoke the words that I'm feeling. A lot of people are saying you took the words right out of my mouth. A lot of people that are biracial, mixed families, they're identifying with us, and they're appreciative of what we said. They say I have a beautiful family. They think that I'm the best looking of them all.
Of course.
Okay, that was a joke. But they always mention that. And then they just really say that you've given me hope. And we've had emails from all over the world, from all the states, from China, Japan, Iraq, Mexico, Canada. It's just been amazing. We're privileged and humbled.
Alex Bryant, pastor of New Life Church in Oak Grove, congratulations on the success of your video, and thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you.
We'll link to his video on our website. It'll be posted with the audio from today's show. KCUR Central Standard's got to take a break, but when we return, another local internet sensation, this one a bit younger and a bit more rockin'. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm sitting here with a father and son. The son, Eli, is in seventh grade, and along with his brothers, he's in a band called Hammerhead, spelled with two D's at the end. The band's sidewalk performance of a Metallica song was caught on video by a passerby, and it blew up online, so much so that Metallica actually saw it and gave the boys props. Eli Ismer, good morning.
Good morning.
Is this whole thing pretty weird?
Yes, it is. It's crazy because it was so unexpected.
Tell me about that show on the Plaza. Was it your first time or one of your first times performing in public, or were you already kind of like used to that sort of thing?
We were pretty used to it because we actually have done that, like, we did that like 11 times actually, like a lot of times before it.
Whoa.
It never got like that crazy, but a lot of people, like, sometimes came, but never, like a lot, so.
It was a Metallica cover that got you all this attention. Are you a big Metallica fan?
Oh, yeah. I love Metallica.
Why?
I used to listen to rock, and I listened to this one song called Enter Sandman. It's, like, their most popular song. And I was like, that's awesome. Let's look into this band. And we started to get that, like, we started liking the heavy stuff, like metal and stuff like that. And yeah.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
Well, I have some more questions for you, Eli, but let's hear the story from your dad's point of view. Luke Ismert, thanks so much for stopping by.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
And for being Eli's ride, of course.
Of course.
How did your sons get into this kind of music? I mean, we heard a little bit of that story from Eli, but did you or your wife have anything to do with it? When I think of, like, 12-year-olds today, I'm not sure I imagine Metallica at the top of their playlists. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've got some Metallica CDs. I've got a large CD collection. And as best I could tell, Henry, Eli's older brother, got into guitar about, what, Eli, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? He's 14 now, so his hands were even smaller then. And I think just gripping those power chords was easy and chugging along. And, you know, I think it sounded good to him. So I think that's how it got going.
Tell me the story of your sons starting a band together from your perspective.
First of all, I'm nervous. I wish I was a pastor with some public speaking experience. Or 12 and not nervous at all, but...
You're doing great.
Well, thank you. You know, it started out with Henry just really banging around on the guitar, and I would say of all of them, Eli's probably the most natural at his instrument. He just had a natural rhythm from when he was in a car seat, you know?
Kicking around and stuff?
Yeah. So those two started playing together, and then Abe, the third oldest, is actually a drummer, but he was... You know, a bass was put into his hands because he didn't have a choice about it. You know, he's just, here's the bass, you're the third guy. So they started playing together, and it wasn't until we watched the video, I guess, that we thought that they were maybe as good as they are. We're just used to it. The house is very loud. You know, I can hear Eli drumming when I'm driving to the house halfway up the street. And it's just a lot of time. I mean, they're down there. It's almost like instead of you know, playing outside or playing video games. They just go down there and do that sometimes a couple hours a day. So
Eli, is that how it is from your point of view, or is there something that you would add?
Yeah, it all started like when my uncle had a drum set, and I just watched him drum, and I was like, that's the coolest thing ever, because I love the sounds, and he was so like funky and stuff. And I just started drumming, and I never had lessons. I just went up to his little room where his drum set was, and I drummed up there. So
Luke, for you, how did it come to your attention that a video of your son's playing music had not only been posted to YouTube, but that it had gone just insanely viral?
The lady who posted the video, Catherine Rose, had reached out to my wife via the Tea Loft. We were playing down in front of the Tea Loft at the plaza, and there was a 10K there that day, and so we know the owners of the Tea Loft, and they said, hey, have the boys come play, and maybe we can get some, you know, some of the joggers and some of the runners to come over and get something at the Tea Loft. And so she wanted to put them inside at first, and we thought, no one's going to come in with that kind of racket inside your place. So we put them outside, and literally there was very few people there. It was a Sunday morning at the plaza, so very few people walking by. And this lady, Catherine Rose, came by and, you know, kind of started rocking out, had her phone up there taking a video, and honestly, that was that. And then the next day, I think, maybe 2 days later, she reached out via the Tea Loft to my wife and said, hey, I posted the video. It went viral. And, you know, I'm thinking 10,000 views, 15,000 views. But by the time I looked at it, it was already over 2 million, I think. And I immediately went into Papa Bear lockdown mode. I was like, oh, man, you know, how do I unplug it? You know, how do I turn it? That was just my initial, like.
Can you explain that Papa Bear lockdown mode?
It was just a gut reaction. You know, I guess it's just a parenting thing. But to me, it wasn't like a, you know, I'd love to see viral videos as much as the next guy, you know, chickens and suits and, you know, things like that. But when
babies,
it's your
making evil faces.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But when it's your kids, it just, all of a sudden I got very protective. I didn't want, you know, millions of eyes on my family. So
why not? What were you afraid of?
You know, it's hard to, I've been trying to put my finger on that, because I think, you know, maybe it's an irrational thing, because it's been a very positive thing. I mean, all the comments they had from people watching the videos were super positive. I mean, you know, it was incredible that the stuff they were saying about the boys and how good they were, and they couldn't believe they were playing old school Metallica, and props to the parents for, you know, raising them with Metallica, things like that. All very positive, but I think maybe there was a fear of just losing control of our family dynamic, our family life. What we, you know, we live pretty quietly. So
I mean, the internet is an odd place, because something that happens just, yeah, as with a very small crowd in real life, IRL, as they say, can suddenly have, yeah, a giant crowd that had been to you invisible. So like, Eli, for you, you know, there are just a few people watching you, and suddenly, invisibly, the crowd that was actually watching your show turns out to be millions of people. I mean, I can't even imagine the size of the performance venue that would hold that many people. What was it like for you?
Well, my dad was scared, and I was kind of like, why? I kind of figured it out, like, why, and it started to make sense, because 20 million is a lot. Well, currently it's at 20 million, but then it was, when I looked at it, it was, like, at 1 million, and my dad got home, and it was at 2 million, and just started to, my dad just got kind of, like, scared about it, but I think it turned out fine.
Were you scared?
No, I thought it was cool, honestly, like. My brothers were like, whoa.
By the time you looked, I mean, did you see it as soon as your parents found out?
I think my mom found out first, and she texted Henry.
Your brother?
Yes. Henry, my brother, he's the guitarist. And
were you guys at school?
He was, I think, getting home. No, he figured out earlier, in school, I think. And then I figured out when I got home, because Henry always has these surprises for me.
Well,
and, yeah.
So about this sort of mixed reaction of excitement, but also a little nervousness. I mean, has that changed how you view other viral online things? I mean, there's so much opportunity online in terms of exposure, but only if that's what you want. There could be a sense of some danger too. You don't know what strangers are going to, how strangers are going to respond to things, whether it's a danger of the emotional impact of a comment or something else.
I think that was our initial fear, was, you know, somebody's going to make fun of their playing or, you know, their singing and just crush them, you know. But I think two things. Number one, I realized that you can't design a viral thing. I mean, that was about as accidental as it gets. I don't know how Alex, the previous guest, feels about that. But, you know, I'm in business. We try to make little viral things, you know, in a small way, and we try to design it. Doesn't happen. The boys played at KC Auto Works, like, I don't know, was it 6-8 weeks ago? And their people, quote unquote, were there, a bunch of metalheads, and they just flocked to them, and we didn't know what it was going to be like. And everybody's got their phones up, and, you know, if anything were to go viral, it would have been that. But Sunday morning on the plaza with no one there goes viral, you know, so. So who knows? So you don't have any control over that. And, you know, me trying to unplug the internet is hilarious, and that doesn't work. And it's just going to, it's got a life of its own. But
though I am curious how you tried to do that.
I reached out to a friend of mine who's in marketing and in, you know, online content creation. And I basically was like, you know, how do we put wraps on this? How can I stop it right where it is? And she probably put the phone on mute and laughed. But she was very respectful and gave me a couple of ideas, and none of which worked. And in retrospect, you can't. You know, it's going to go.
So maybe that's what's scary about the internet when it's your kids, is that you absolutely can't control it.
No way. But
and it doesn't have anyone's interest in mind.
No. No, and you get a lot of pressure for, you know, you got to let the, you know, give the boys their chance, and you can't cost them their shot. And on the other, you know, I get that. And on the other hand, I'm going, I just want them to have, you know, a regular childhood for right now. They're young kids, you know. I don't, if they're going to have their shot, they're going to have their shot. That was my take.
Yeah.
So, but I do feel like on the other side of it that we have been able to, you know, stay relatively in control and, you know, nicely, tell people no or no thanks, or, you know, you can pick your opportunities.
Eli, for you, when you found out about all of this, did you have fantasies of becoming the next big thing, or what were your thoughts? Where did your mind go?
Well, I think this has happened like a couple times, and it just kind of trailed off. Like, you can't really expect to be the next Metallica or something like that, because sometimes it just kind of goes away because it's like the internet and I don't know.
You're kind of zen, like don't hold on too tightly.
Yeah, I don't think that is why, like, I don't think that is why we would become the next Metallica or something. I think it'd just because like you have to kind of start playing and stuff, and you have to play through, I'm trying to word this rightly, but what I'm saying is that most people, like, most things that go viral, they try to hold on to it for too long, and it doesn't work. You just got to let it go and stuff like that.
You are very mature in the face of instantaneous celebrity, I have to say, for a seventh grader.
Thank you.
But Metallica did hear you play because of this video and responded to the video. What was that like? I mean, you're obviously a big enough Metallica fan that you're covering the band's songs.
Well, Henry came home and went crazy, and he was like, Metallica just saw it. And I was like, no way the real Metallica saw it. That's my favorite band, and it'd be so hard to meet. And they just saw our video, you know? It was awesome.
Do you think that you're going to try and meet them out of this, or has that ship sailed?
Well, we don't really have a way. Like, we didn't put out an email or anything. Well, we have a Facebook. Like, we just made a Facebook, but I don't think there really is a way that we could have met them.
Well, I hope if anyone in Metallica happens to hear this interview that they come and find you.
Okay.
Eli Ismert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Luke Ismert, thank you.
Thanks, Gina.
When we get back, we'll be talking about that space between East 18th Street and West 18th Street. What would you like to see happening there? Do the two districts need to somehow be connected? I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Based on that music in the background, you might think we're entering some kind of lounge. But actually, we're hanging out under the Highway 71 overpass on 18th Street in the daytime. There's a block party going on. People are enjoying free coffee and back massages. On the street, the four lanes usually dedicated to car traffic have been reduced to two. Joe Comets stopped by to check it out.
This is such a small thing, but at least it's showing kind of what the way it could look to connect the west part of our city and the east part of our city and kind of bridge that gap, pun intended.
In addition to the pop-up amenities, a makeshift protected bike lane has been blocked off using potted plants and parked vehicles. It's a cyclist's dream come true, for a day anyway.
I'm actually looking into biking across on 18th to get to work. You know, next week this would come really in handy, but I don't know if it's going to be up that long.
Yeah, if bike lanes existed on 18th Street here, we'd be here all the time.
This is an area that really could use some improvement, for sure. Definitely with the big gap between the Crossroads neighborhood and 18th and Vine 2 vibrant areas, but in between, there's pretty much nothing.
I'm Gina Kaufman. For the rest of the hour on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be exploring the possibilities for connecting East and West 18th Street, two districts that can feel worlds apart even though they're only a couple miles distance between them. Last week, what we just heard was a group staging a so-called intervention in that gap, a pop-up block showing an idea of what it could be. So, Kate Garman, I want to start with you. You're the innovation analyst for Kansas City, Missouri. Do you see a problem to be solved in this part of the city? I mean, is innovating something like what those people witnessed that day? Is that part of what the office is concerned with?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to talk about 18th Street. It's an area with just huge potential, and we recognize this. We were the top seven finalists for the Department of Transportation Smart City grant, which we lost to Columbus, unfortunately, but by no means are stopping our efforts. And when we planned that out, we saw some serious potential on 18th Street. And if we had won, we would have designated it as an area to test driverless cars, which seems like a huge leap for that area, but it just goes to show how much we can do with the city in development. And the Better Block just was a great example to physically show what basic steps and infrastructure for bike lanes and for all modes of transportation to go on that street can do for the city to really connect to culturally important areas. So yes, it is certainly a priority for our office.
Infrastructure is one piece of it, so making it very easy for people to just jog back and forth, and I totally appreciate that. But what about motivating people to make that trip in the first place? Because what happens in these two districts is kind of different. And so how do you put that thought in people's minds that, hey, I am right just blocks away from 18th and Vine, or conversely, I am just blocks away from all these art galleries?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we don't just want to provide a piece of transportation to where no one gets off in between, right? I mean, the plan is for activity to be all throughout that corridor and to make it as easy as possible. I mean, I think the streetcar alone shows how if you provide a really simple and easy form of transportation, people are more likely to go up and down certain corridors of your city. And taking that success model, you know, the streetcar, $1.7 billion of development is what happened just from simply making it easier to move around. And I think by making forms of transportation available on 18th Street, along with some other efforts that we're really excited about, including an innovation center on 18th Street, this is what's going to attract people to that neighborhood.
Well, we've got someone else in the room, Daniel Edwards, and I want to talk to him. He has his own relationship with East 18th Street, but I first want to go ahead and put the call out to our listeners that if you have an idea for what would make these two parts of our city so physically close together, but maybe in our minds far apart, how to bring those closer, call 816-235-2888, and don't delay because we don't have much time. Daniel Edwards, tell us about your relationship with the 18th and Vine District.
Hey, everybody. We actually, my family grew up there. I went to Lincoln High School over in the neighborhood. And more recently, in 2014, my wife and I got married at the old abandoned workhouse castle, which is on 20th and Vine Street. Back then, 2014, Kansas City was actually ranked number 4 in America for most blighted and abandoned properties by 24/7 Wall Street. So we knew that there was a problem with blight and abandonment, and I live it. We lived it. We kind of became numb to it. And then once we saw 4 blocks of city residents displaced from their homes, we started to figure out what can we do to get to fix this, and what can we do to like attract people to the neighborhood and to the community. And what we realized is that Kansas City, the east side of Kansas City, just struggles because we just don't have enough awesome people there. The density of awesome people they've just disappeared. And so there are still great people in the neighborhood still trying to do amazing work, but it's just not enough. So how do we get more eyes, more people to the neighborhood to get it to be a self-sustaining community of its own, and then attract people to it?
So, do you see what's happening over in the crossroads over on West 18th Street and notice those differences and have some sort of explanation for them that lives in your mind?
Yeah, I do. I think the best explanation that I've found is that people are just like excited to collaborate once you cross over the highway. And once we cross over Troost or we cross over the highway, the collaboration is endless. You can go to anyone and talk to them about what you're working on. They're like, how can we help? What can we do? How can we get involved? The second you cross back over Troost, the walls come back up. The defenses come back up. And it's really difficult to collaborate to bring really awesome ideas to a community that is so guarded and so defensive.
Can you explain what you mean a little more? I mean, give me maybe some examples of who you're talking about or what form the resistance takes?
Well, I think there's a lot of youthful energy in Kansas City just all together. And as this youthful energy is growing and we're learning and we're discovering things, and it's not just black people, it's white people, it's Hispanic people, it's Asian people, we all are coming around this thing of like, let's just make Kansas City awesome. We could care less of what it looks like or how we get there, but how do we just make Kansas City just badass, for lack of better terms? I don't even know if I can say that.
And Daniel and I, we've been part of a group that's gotten together, and it's kind of this breath of fresh air, and we're just done. We're tired of divides, and we want all of Kansas City to be great. So we've started having barbecues on both on east and west side of Kansas City because we're done with lines. And
so when you say you're having barbecues on both sides, do you mean separate barbecues or like some sort of like giant barbecue that spans that line?
Oh, somehow? That would be kind of awesome.
That would be the biggest barbecue ever.
We should just do that, right?
Right. Well, the American Royal went to Kansas. We should start something on Missouri now.
But so it sounds like, though, you get people to cross lines to do that. Just pop-up events, but how do you get them to do it for those?
Relationships. I think that's what we've been missing in Kansas City is like people, we start all these groups and organizations to try to make an impact, but then people don't, they miss out on the key point of building relationships. So our barbecues have just been like, come hang out, grab a hot dog, grab a hamburger, grab a beer, talk to somebody, build a friend, require it to go out and meet people. So,
well, let's hear what some of our listeners have to say about this divide between East and West 18th Street, the sort of gap between these places. We'll talk first with Bill, a Troost resident. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Gina. Good day.
Good day.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Daniel.
What can you share, Bill?
I want to first reinforce everything Daniel just said. I'm going to add aces to all of it. He's got the pulse of what would be required to further the bigger agenda, which is to create a linking of our East and West. Instead of a dividing line, let's be talking about a bridge. And specifically, I'd like to go to a bit of history here to let you know that the city has been involved in a link-up mentality since 2009. Saj Kaya, Tony Quinn, Saste Mosley, Anita, and myself, we all formed a ad hoc group, which we incorporated in the state, and we called ourselves Green Light Go, and we approached the city council to support us as a link up of the east and west ends of the 18th Street and both the east and west of 18th Street. And to give you a particular about that, we actually appeared in front of city council and requested a resolution supporting our efforts, and we got it. And that was under Mayor Funkhauser.
Well, congrats, Bill. I hate to cut this short, but I do want to make sure that we can kind of pick up and use this information to learn something about our city. And I am curious for those listening out there who might have an idea about how to connect these two parts of the city. Bill's talking about, you know, he got some people together, he made a group, he went to City Hall. How does someone with an idea approach the city and make something formally happen, get involved in changing something?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot of avenues. But what we're trying to do now is, we started Urban Momentum, which is a monthly meeting, and it's basically getting City Hall outside of City Hall. And it's a way, we started it with the Smart City project, and the concept is complicated, and we want to get citizens involved, but it's really expanded into how do we just get our citizens more involved with what we're doing with the government. And we host it. The last one was hosted at Double Ship Brewery on 18th Street for the purpose of, let's talk about this neighborhood, let's get people down here. And I think what Daniel and I are doing is these grassroots organizations, and you can contact us directly, and you can always use government channels as well.
So that sounds more accessible than I would have thought.
Mm-hmm. We've done it on the grassroots level. They're very government. I'm not government. I try to stay away as much as possible. But Our United City on Facebook is a group. If people just go and request to be added to Our United City, it's where we started doing all of our barbecues at. It's how we've been trying to connect both sides of Troost and to do just awesome stuff. There's a lot of pain and hurt going on around the country in our city. But how do we just put it together, a group of people who just want to go do awesome things to make Kansas City really, really great? And then we create opportunities that hopefully as we build that social capital, we can then go to the city to say, hey, city, we need this or we need that.
Let's talk to Jason in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jason.
Hey, good morning. Great conversation. Really appreciate the efforts of both of your guests. You know, it's the divide in my mind of that area where West 18th Street around Grinders starts to peter out. And you then get into about a mile of really pedestrian unfriendly area to get to 18th Street and Vine. And I think that if we were able to see some sort of either assistance from the city, but infill development, something that could happen organically along that stretch of 18th Street to connect the two neighborhoods, or some sort of transportation a la streetcar, although probably not to that level.
What are your thoughts about the differences between the two districts? I mean, is it partly that the gap between these spaces is a big gap in terms of our perception of them?
You know, I don't know that I have any particular insight to this, but if you remember when the original effort to reinvigorate 18th and Vine happened, I think it missed the mark, and it was not an organic effort, whereas the Crossroads completely was an organic situation that kind of grew over the years.
Yeah, artists buying up buildings, flocking.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
exactly right. And I think that 18th and Vine has come a long way since those times, but it wasn't an organic situation. It was kind of it just missed the mark.
Well, Dan, you've lived, you know, this is an area that is intimate to you. This is your family's neighborhood.
Yes. I think the organic components of the community is coming back, but it's coming back with a new generation of people who are just really excited to see what this neighborhood could be.
Can you describe that to me a little more? I mean, is that an actual movement that's kind of happening?
Yes, it is a movement that's happening. It's actually called Movement KC, but it's just, it's just people who have seen what our heritage and our legacy could be of just the jazz community, and that we could actually expand this outside of just for years and decades. The focus has been like, they say it's been national, but the focus has been really local. How do we do things on a local level? There's 1,258 jazz festivals every year around the world that celebrates our neighborhood. So how do we reimagine what could even be developed between 18th, between Crossroads and 18th Street on a global scale, as opposed to it just being like really local, really focused on the neighborhood? Because if we bring the world here, then our neighborhood residents will actually come to that as well. So
from just a few blocks to the west, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and Daniel shows, I think connectivity is key in relationships with people and resources. Yeah. And people really want to see this happen. And I think as we continue to, you know, physically and in relationship wise bridge this gap, you can see people who want to do things have the resources to do it.
Mardi Gras is an example of a time when those two parts of the city, just for a few hours, really seem very connected. And that hasn't always been the case. But a few mm-hmm. years back, you know, that sort of informal parade that happens crossed that line.
Yeah.
And I was there, and I was really surprised by how powerful it felt to traverse that distance on foot and to realize really within my own self how very, very short the distance was. Are there other events? I mean, you're talking about pop-up events on either side, and I was joking about the giant barbecue that somehow spanned two districts. But really, are there other things that within one moment make those two places feel like they share a kind of synergy?
Well, the last thing I can remember would be the Royals Parade, but I think our whole city shared that synergy. And I think we have a perfect opportunity with just the pop-up mentality. There's tons of Kansas City, young Kansas City jazz artists who are creating, and they just need spaces to create that could be all up and down 18th and Vine. There's very few venues for them to perform. So if we could build those into that strip.
Let's hear very, very quickly from Philip in Midtown. Philip, you're going to have to go fast, and I'm sorry.
Okay, pop-up is great, but the fact of the matter is that the actual linkage requires incremental development, and that means residential. A perfect example of the worst ideas is when the Foch brothers wanted to put in housing, and they couldn't do it because of our present response with regard to tax increment financing and the reluctance of city organizations to approve that, because what that means, if you don't have residential, you don't have an anchor
okay.
in that direction.
Let's get some answers okay. from our guests on this before we jog on out. What do you think of what he's saying, that residential is a key component, that people just populating that whole stretch sort of more continuously would make a difference?
Well, I know Kate has some thoughts on that, so I'll pass it over. But just a really quick stat, this neighborhood used to have 41,000 people, and now it's less than 7,000. So when you talk about a 80 or 76% decrease in people, that's where you have, I think, residential is a key component.
Yeah, and to brag on what Daniel's doing, he's building 1,000 homes in under 10 years.
Yeah.
And we think that by making actual infrastructure builds, people will want to build residential spaces naturally. It'll come.
It sounds so much like what we're talking about is that there are needs on 18th and Vine, on the East 18th Street side, that are preventing this connection from feeling natural. Is that your sense? That it's sort of...
Well, yeah, but I think the biggest connection that we need is just like the natural people to come and be a part of the conversation with us. So...
And we need to make it, as a city, just so easy and natural to want to go to the neighborhoods and in between. It just feels like the thing to do. And that's what Daniel and I are working on.
So we'll work on more conversations about these in-between spaces on future shows. Our time is up. Kate Garman with us from the city's Office of Innovation. Keep us posted.
We'll do.
And Dan Edwards, I've really enjoyed meeting you today.
Yeah. Go join Our United City on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. You can listen back to this conversation and our discussion about going viral at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have all that ready for you later today. Tomorrow, plans for a Westport Quick Trip expansion come with the threat of even possibly closing a city street. Another check-in on change in Westport tomorrow. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date.